So let's cover the last sensory experience of smell. The smell receptors, the olfactory bulbs, are the direct extensions of a part of the brain which is known as the hypothalamus, which is connected to another part of the brain which is known as the limbic system. These are parts of the brain which are also frequently referred to as the brain's brain. And they go back to amphibian and reptilian times and also go back to the era in our evolutionary history where we were surrounded by predators, and in fact we learned to become predators as we developed the flight-fright response. When I was in medical school, the way we remembered the four functions of the limbic system was the four Fs: fighting, fleeing, feeding, and the physical act that's responsible for the propagation of the species. And even today, it seems that these four things govern the behavior of all species. These smell receptors, the limbic system, the hypothalamus, memory, behavior, and autonomic function are all very intimately connected. So once again, memory, behavior, autonomic function, smell. They're all very intimately connected. And the connection is in this part of the brain, the limbic system and the hypothalamus. So it seems now, it's becoming very clear that every emotion that you have has an autonomic response to it. The most common is the flight-fright response. As predators or surrounded by predators, all we did was either run or fight. And that's the most primitive response that's built into our genes. Now it gets triggered with traffic jams and hurt feelings, the same thing. But this response has its own autonomic expression. You run or you fight, and immediately your blood pressure goes up, your heart rate goes up, your pupils dilate, your sweat glands open up, your hair stands up. This all happens simultaneously. It's in fact to help you either to run or to fight. But each kind of emotion has its own repertoire of autonomic function. Each kind of emotion is associated with its own kind of physiology, you might say. So fear has its own physiology, and anger has its own physiology, and love has its own physiology, and compassion and sexual excitement, they all have their own physiology. But because these things are all connected to each other, each emotion, it seems, has its own odor. It generates a hormone. And this hormone is called a pheromone, and in fact, it has a distinct odor. You may not be able to consciously smell the odor, but your hypothalamus responds to it. Your olfactory bulbs respond to it. There's a gland here called the vomeronasal gland that responds to pheromones, which are the hormones associated with emotion. And if you pick up these odors, even subconsciously, then your emotions are influenced. There was an experiment somebody published from a university in California several years ago, where they took mice and they gave them electrical shocks, and then they removed the mice from the room, they bring in other mice into the room, and as soon as these other mice enter the room, they panic. And the reason is they're breathing in the hormones of fear left behind by the mice that were being given the electrical shocks. So today, if you say, I went into this room and I felt the atmosphere was really tense, you're not speaking metaphorically. You're breathing in the hormones of anxiety, and your body is reacting to it with anxiety. Or if you say, I went to this holy shrine and I felt peace, love, and compassion, again, you're responding to something that's actually happening in your physiology. Or you say, I don't know what it is about this chap, but he gives me the creeps. That too is something that your physiology is picking up. It's picking up unhealthy emotions in this person that you're reacting to. Emerson, the great American philosopher, said, who you are shouts so loudly in my ears, I cannot hear what you're saying. Maybe he was speaking of a physiological fact. We are, you know, our emotions, our minds can't be squeezed into our bodies. They extend outside. And now we even have a physiological basis to see how that might be happening. So, not only do emotions have odors and hormones associated with them, but each emotion triggers the similar emotion in the person that is in that immediate environment. You feel the anxiety, you feel the anger, you feel the sexual excitement, you feel the compassion, the love, the healing, whatever that emotion is. And you feel it at a subtle level in your body. Ayurveda has understood this for thousands of years. And in fact, Ayurvedic aromatherapies based on body types, based on illness, based on neuro-associative condition responses, how to link memory, emotion, behavior, autonomic function in order to evoke a healing response. So, let's go over some of that. Any aroma or smell that is floral or fruity, that comes either from a fruit or a flower, is vata balancing. So vata disorders. And what are vata disorders? There are things like migraine, PMS, muscle aches and pains, muscle spasms, cold intolerance, insomnia, restlessness, anxiety, palpitations of the heart. These are all vata disorders. These vata disorders are balanced by floral and fruity essences. All kapha imbalances, and kapha imbalances are obesity, nasal congestion, sinus congestion, lung congestion, fluid retention, hyperlipidemia, fluid in the joints, all these disorders are corrected or balanced by stimulating smells, those that will stimulate metabolism. These include smells like camphor, eucalyptus. They include all pungent and spicy aromas. All pitta imbalances, and these include hypertension, inflammatory disorders of the skin, inflammatory bowel disease, ulcers, reflux, esophagitis, coronary artery disease, inflammatory types of arthritis. These are all balanced by cooling smells, pitta balancing smells. And cooling smells include sandalwood and all the various varieties of mint. Sandalwood, spearmint, peppermint, mint in general. There are two ways to use aromatherapy. One is just to burn it in an aroma pot in the room. The other is to personalize it. Either use the aromatherapy along with massage, or in fact, to just take a little bit of the aroma oil and put it over the lip and just keep it there and smell it. You can also train somebody to evoke a response through meditation. And let me give you an example of how that's done. Let's look at the two major characteristics of vata and pitta and kapha. The two major characteristics of any vata disorder is that vata is cool and dry, right? Space and air, cool and dry. Pitta is warm and moist. Kapha is cool and moist. So once again, vata is cool and dry. Pitta is warm and moist, and kapha is cool and moist. Now, any disease that anybody has can be looked at as a vata disorder or a kapha disorder or a pitta disorder. Let's take one example. Let's take ulcer. Ulcer is what? A pitta disorder. There's inflammation here. Stomach ulcer is, therefore, being pitta, it's hot, warm, and it's wet, moist. Now what you can do is, you can teach a person to do an advanced meditation technique. This is how I would treat an ulcer, if a patient came to me with an ulcer. instead of writing a prescription for Tagamet or whatever the latest H2 blocker is, I would teach them meditation, preferably primordial sound meditation, to get them into the gap, or mindfulness meditation. That's the first thing I would do. So in general, meditation has a dramatic effect. Most people who have ulcers, just learning meditation, the ulcer goes away in a few weeks. So that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I might do is to teach them a sutra practice. So I might take them into the meditation, and then what I might do is, I would tell them at the end of meditation to stop the mantra or stop the mindfulness meditation and put their attention on the stomach where the ulcer is. And then every 15 seconds, introduce two sutras. And these two sutras would be cool and dry. Okay? Because the ulcer is warm and moist. So they'd put their attention here, and then they'd just every 15 seconds introduce that sutra, cool, 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 etc. 4 or 5 times, and then dry, dry, dry. You see a dramatic response. You see a dramatic response just to this. And I'm giving you just one example. This is a pitta disorder. You can take a vata, kapha disorder, use the same principles. The opposite of what's out of balance. Now, once the person starts doing this, at the same time as they were practicing this, I would rub a little bit of sandalwood oil on their lip, which is a pitta pacifying oil, pitta balancing oil, because it's cooling, or mint. And their hypothalamus, their limbic system, which remember I told you, connects autonomic response with smell, with behavior, and with memory. Their limbic system will strengthen that association. So after a while, whenever they have their ulcer pain, all they have to do is take a drop of sandalwood oil and rub it on their lip, and immediately the ulcer cools down and the pain goes. This is called neuro-associative conditioning. Of course, in Ayurveda, there are fancy terms for it. This is Ayurvedic healing through the knowledge of the tanmatras, how one thing connects with the other in consciousness. I've treated patients with angina pectoris. Instead of taking nitroglycerin, I wouldn't recommend that to anyone to do that. But if they are trained well enough, you can take, instead of nitroglycerin, they just apply a little vata balancing aroma oil here, and they've learned how to relax the coronary vessels through meditation and sutra practice. So you can start to heal yourself and people if you understand the physiology. Now, I'm explaining this to you in detail, but I don't want you to try it immediately on yourself, because you need to be trained and you need to be careful that you don't come off a medication which may in fact be very helpful to you at this moment. But I think you understand the principles of how taste and smell can be used to evoke healing in the body. Seven, despite the appearance of being separate individuals, we are all connected to patterns of intelligence governing the cosmos. You and your environment are one. If you choose, you can experience yourself in a state of unity with everything you contact. In ordinary waking consciousness, you touch your finger to a rose and feel it as solid. But in truth, one bundle of energy and information, your finger, is contacting another bundle of energy and information, the rose. Your finger and the thing it touches are both just minute outcroppings of the infinite field we call the universe. In unity consciousness, people, things, and events out there all become part of my body. In fact, I am only a mirror of relationships centered on these influences. The possibility of experiencing unity has tremendous implications for aging, because when there is harmonious interaction between me and my extended body, I feel joyful, healthy, and youthful. Seeing ourselves as separate, we create chaos and disorder between ourselves and things out there. We war with people and destroy the environment. What makes us old isn't stress so much as the perception of stress.
someone who doesn't see the world out there as a threat can coexist with the environment, free of the damage created by the stress response. In many ways, the most important thing you can do to experience the world without aging is to nurture the knowledge that the world is you. 8. Time is not absolute. The underlying reality of all things is eternal, and what we call time is really quantified eternity. Although our bodies and the whole physical world are a constant display of change, there is more to reality than process. The universe was born and is evolving. Before the instant of the Big Bang, time and space didn't exist as we know them. The whole notion of time as an arrow shooting inexorably forward has been shattered forever in the complex geometries of quantum space, where multidimensional strings and loops carry time in all directions and even bring it to a halt. The only absolute left to us is the timeless, for now we realize that our entire universe is just one incident springing forth out of a larger reality. What we sense as seconds, minutes, hours, days, and years are cut-up bits of this larger reality. It is up to you, the perceivers, to cut up the timeless any way you like. Your awareness creates the time you experience. Being able to identify with a reality that is not bounded by time is extremely important. Otherwise, there is no escape from the decay that time inevitably brings. You can catch a glimpse of timelessness with a simple mind-body exercise. Choose a time of day when you feel relaxed and unpressured. Sit quietly and take your watch off, placing it nearby so that you can easily refer to it. Now close your eyes and be aware of your breathing. Imagine your whole body rising and falling with the flow of each breath. After a minute or two, you will be aware of warmth and relaxation pervading your muscles. When you feel very settled and quiet inside, slowly open your eyes and peek at the second hand of your watch. What is it doing? It may stop entirely for what may seem 1 to perhaps 3 seconds, or it may move, but at a slower pace than usual. Once you have had the experience of seeing a watch stop, you will never again doubt that time is a product of perception. The only time there is the one you are aware of. You can learn to take your awareness into the region of timelessness at will. Meditation is the classic technique for mastering this experience. In the state of timelessness, you have the sensation of fullness. When this experience becomes a reality, the fears associated with change disappear. The fragmentation of eternity into seconds, hours, days, and years becomes secondary. The perfection of every moment becomes primary. Number 9. Everyone inhabits a reality of non-change, lying beyond all change. The experience of this reality brings change under our control. At the present moment, the only physiology you can maintain is time-based. However, the fact that time is tied to awareness implies that you could maintain an entirely different style of functioning, the physiology of immortality, which would correspond to the experience of non-change. All of our reactions are part and parcel of the time-bound self and its tendencies. Yet in a subtle way, we all sense that there is something inside us that has not changed very much, if at all, since we were infants. This me, whom the ancient sages in India simply call the self, serves as my real reference point for experience. In unity consciousness, the world can be explained as the flow of spirit, which is awareness. Our whole goal is to establish an intimate relationship with this spirit. 10. We are not victims of aging, sickness, and death. These are part of the scenery, not the seer, who is immune to any form of change. Life at its source is creation. When you get in touch with your own inner intelligence, you get in touch with the creative core of life. In the old paradigm, control of life was assigned to DNA, an enormously complex molecule. In the new paradigm, control of life belongs to awareness. The billions of changes occurring in ourselves are only the passing scenery of life. Behind their mask is the seer who represents the source of the flow of awareness. Every one of ourselves is nothing but intelligence organized into various layers of visible and invisible patterns. We are made victims of sickness, aging, and death by gaps in our self-knowledge. To lose awareness is to lose intelligence. To lose intelligence is to lose control over the end product of intelligence, the human body. Therefore, the most valuable lesson the new paradigm can teach us is this. If you want to change your body, change your awareness first. Our fearful images of growing old, coupled with high rates of disease and senility among the elderly, result in grim, self-fulfilling expectations. But one underlying assumption, that humans have to age, has not been radically challenged. Aging made sense in the scheme of nature, where all things change, fade away, and die. It makes much less sense in a world where an endless flow of ever-renewing intelligence is present all around us. Which view you adopt is your choice. Matter is a captive moment in time and space. And when we see our world and ourselves materialistically, the captive aspects of the universe assume too much importance. I want you to experience just how fluid and effortless existence can be when your worldview shifts, because despite its solid physical appearance, your body is very much like a river. It changes as the moment changes. And if your consciousness could do the same, there would be no gaps in your life, no memory of past trauma to trigger new pain, no anticipation of future hurt to make you contract in fear. Your body is the river of life that sustains you, yet it does so humbly, without asking for recognition. If you sit and listen to it, you will find that a powerful intelligence dwells within you. It isn't an intelligence of words, but compared to the millions of years of wisdom woven into each cell, the intelligence of words doesn't seem so grand. There is no limit to the energy, information, and intelligence concentrated in one person's existence. In physical form, this infinite creativity has been embodied in your cells. In unmanifest form, it is expressed in the mind's silence, the void that is actually a fullness of untold possible meanings, possible truths, possible creations. The emptiness at the core of every atom is the womb of the universe. In this emptiness is a silence where time's breath does not wither, but only renews. This is the land where no one is old. This land is nowhere but in yourself.
Is there any connection between what's happening in your mind, in your consciousness, and A, the incidence of diabetes, and B, the complications of diabetes, and C, the precipitating event that results in somebody who's predisposed to actually getting diabetes? And the answer is yes. There are all kinds of very interesting studies. In fact, somebody did a study in among the Pima Indian population in Arizona. As I told you, they have a 60% incidence. By the time they grow into adulthood, you have a 60% incidence or 70% incidence of overt diabetes in the Pima Indians. So there was this research study which they went to this American Indian tribe, and they took young people who had no diabetes, no evidence of diabetes, and actually had them do a mathematical test, which was computer generated. Every 5 minutes they have to solve the mathematical test. And at the same time, the machine makes a very irritating noise. And just the frustration of doing that, the anxiety and the frustration, the blood sugar went up, many cases precipitated overt diabetes. immediately after that. So it shows that in a person who's genetically predisposed, even minor degrees of stress will start to elevate blood sugar and start to precipitate the clinical appearance of that diabetes. And of course, when you're under stress, there are two kinds of things that happen. Diabetics have to be very careful about the amount of food they eat. They have to be very careful about the kind of food they eat. They have to be very careful about their insulin dose or other medication they're taking. They have to be very careful about exercise. All these have to be monitored. And if you're under stress, then you're not going to be doing that. You just don't comply as well. So that's the indirect way that stress affects diabetes. But the direct way is really a much more obvious route to how what happens in your consciousness influences the incidence of diabetes. Any of these experiences in consciousness, which we'll call stress, fear, hostility, guilt, depression, anxiety, and anger, they have a direct effect on these two hormones, adrenaline and cortisol. These are hormones that are secreted by your adrenal gland. So anytime you feel stressed, adrenaline goes up and cortisol goes up. And adrenaline and cortisol have an effect on these other hormones, particularly glucagon, which is an antagonist of insulin, also produced by the pancreas, so it antagonizes the effects of insulin. And also growth hormone goes up, which is an antagonist of insulin. And so, first of all, there's either absolute or insulin deficiency, either the pancreas is not producing insulin, or even if it is, it's not working. And now you have all these insulin antagonists being secreted, that causes the blood sugar to go up, and that causes the onset of diabetes. So it's very clear, at least it makes scientific and logical sense, that if a person is having anxiety or stress or anything else happening in their consciousness that is perceived as a threat to them, one of the simplest definitions of stress, every half an hour, and as they begin to drink it every half an hour, they also monitor the ama, they'll find that several things will happen. First, as the ama is mobilized, they'll see that their tongue gets even more muddy and coated, breath starts feeling quite stale, and they get fatigued. But as they continue to do it, and they may get joint pains and arthralgias, pains in the joints, fatigue, muscle weakness. But as that continues to be mobilized, may take a day, 2 days, or 3 days, then as their tongue becomes pink and moist, their breath starts to smell fresh, and they feel loss of energy. And one of the things that interferes with your metabolic rate is that if there is too much ama in your system, your metabolic rate is slow. So when the ama is removed, metabolic rate starts to come up. And in fact, we found that those patients who have resistance to losing weight, despite everything, you know, you're practicing eating awareness, they're practicing kapha pacifying diet, they're taking the kapha balancing herbal combinations, and still it doesn't seem to be working, you start them on this little simple routine with hot water, not fasting or anything, this is just an addition to their daily activity. Within 2-3 days, they suddenly start to mobilize food and fat and fluid from their body. They start to lose weight. It's one of the most effective things you can do for somebody who's really frustrated and not losing weight. You can add this to their regimen. So how do you decide where stress management, meditation, biofeedback really helps? This is also what we were doing at Joslin Clinic. We started to take patients with diabetes and we would measure their blood sugar frequently and we would also monitor their stress levels on a scale of 1 to 10. And you can do that either subjectively, which is you ask the patient, you say, if you're really feeling totally calm and relaxed, that's a level one. And if you're so jittery that you can't even sit still for a second and you're full of anxiety, that's a level 10. You can self-monitor your stress level. But there's another way of doing it these days, and that is through biofeedback. And I don't know how familiar with you are with biofeedback. All kinds of very interesting biofeedback instruments available these days. We're in the process of setting up a biofeedback lab at our center, which will be monitoring brain waves, monitoring heart wave coherence, monitoring body temperature, heart rate, skin resistance, the amount of sweat you have in your skin, etc., etc. There are many ways of monitoring stress in your body. But one of the simplest ways that has been used traditionally in the so-called lie detector test is what you do is you monitor the resistance in the skin to the flow of electricity. And if somebody is very, very, very stressed, then what happens is their skin resistance decreases. The resistance in their skin to the flow of electricity decreases, which means electricity flows faster in the skin if you're very highly stressed. And if you're very relaxed, then your skin resistance to the flow of electricity increases. Electricity flows slower. And you can monitor that. You can feed that information into a machine. And if the skin resistance is low, which means you're stressed, then the machine makes a big noise. And if the skin resistance is high, which means you're not that stressed, then the machine doesn't make that big noise. And you can actually calibrate both the noise and can calibrate other things, so you can actually measure skin resistance, flow of electricity, and say how stressed a person is. So that's a very convenient way, and the technology is getting better and better, of teaching a patient to monitor their own stress levels. And at the same time, patients are taught how to monitor their blood sugar level. And if you see something like this, where stress level and blood sugar level are not related, then you know that this patient is not going to, his diabetes or her diabetes is not being influenced by what's happening in their consciousness. But if you see something like this, where the blood sugar and the stress levels parallel each other, then you know for sure that this is a kind of person who would enormously benefit just by practicing meditation. And this is what we started to do in Joslin Clinic. Take patients with really complicated diabetes, impossible to manage, and teach them a meditation technique twice a day. 15 minutes to 20 minutes, sitting quietly, doing a mantra, primordial sound meditation, something similar, or doing other kinds of meditation. But our experience mostly is with primordial sound meditation. What starts to happen is that many other people have done these studies. Dr. Benson at Harvard has done studies teaching some other kind of relaxation response. People have done studies teaching other kinds of meditation like mindfulness, breathing techniques, etc., with similar results. You start to see immediately that the diabetes is easier to control, and as a result of that, you have a decreasing incidence of complications as you follow these people over a period of time. There is some correlation between type 2 diabetes and depression, and you should always be looking out for that, because depression in type 2 diabetes and in adults can masquerade. It doesn't, you know, just because you'll be using the word depression doesn't mean that a person is sad all the time. Depression is not always manifested by the experience of sadness. The symptoms of depression can be very, very misleading. A change in appetite, inability to concentrate, a loss of memory, insomnia, especially waking up early in the morning or in the middle of the night. These can all be symptoms of depression. One should be looking for that in type 2 diabetes because there's a definite correlation between the two. You need to treat the depression as well. Also, in type 1 diabetes, which frequently occurs in the young, frequently you'll see young teenagers with type 1 diabetes who at the same time have anorexia or bulimia or an eating disorder. I'm just mentioning this because it makes it very difficult to treat these people unless you're addressing that as well. Okay, and there is some evidence that if you have type A personality, it's difficult to control diabetes as well. So these are the mind-body treatments that have been employed in the treatment of diabetes. It's almost unforgivable, I think, if a patient with diabetes is not monitoring their own blood sugar levels and not taught how to do that, because in the absence of self-monitoring, it's almost impossible to get good control of their blood sugar. It's almost unforgivable if they're not monitoring their stress levels, because stress plays a crucial role in the management of diabetes. This is one category of patients that should definitely all be using a biofeedback instrument to monitor that. And you can teach them all these wonderful techniques of all the techniques we mentioned yesterday, like the sound technique through attention and intention. You can teach them breathing techniques. You can teach them simple meditations, link it to aromatherapy, etc. And you suddenly start to see that they get convinced that it is really helping their disease because they see the effect when they measure their blood sugar. They see the effect when they use the biofeedback instrument. It's so obvious to them that these are the perfect candidates for biofeedback training as well. Stress management techniques, usually here I'm talking about meditation, but there are so many other things that help during stress. And just briefly, and just a list of other things that you can do to improve a person's condition when they're under extreme stress. The traditional things that have been used are laughter therapy, of course exercise, massage, visualization, music, changing environment. All these are effective ways of managing stress. Diet, I want to talk to that for a few minutes because the diet that you give in type 1 diabetes is very different from the diet that you would give in type 2 diabetes. Type 1, from an Ayurvedic perspective, type 1, if you look at the patient, they are insulin deficient. They have a lot of the classic symptoms of diabetes, which traditionally are polyuria, which means lots of urine, because the sugar goes out through the kidneys, it's filtered, and with it, it takes a huge water load. Polyuria, lots of urination. Polydipsia, lot of thirst. And polyphagia, feeling hungry all the time. That's because even though they're getting all this nutrition, they just can't use it. The insulin is not working. So those are the classic symptoms of especially type 1 diabetes. Polyuria, polydipsia, polyphagia. And you know, this was described 6,000 years ago by a great rishi called Sushruta, who was also the most important plastic surgeon of Ayurveda. It seems in India about 4,000 to 6,000 years ago, during the time of Sushruta, there was a law that if somebody was found guilty of adultery, they would chop their nose off. And Sushruta had the best plastic surgery practice. He used to do rhinoplasties. He used to do nose jobs. This is at least 4,000 years ago. And his textbooks are still available and they show the 105 types of nose jobs that he did. And he used to take leaves from a peepal tree and he used to do all his models of the different types of shapes that he could do, the different types of rhinoplasties that he could do. So he was a great plastic surgeon. But he was also a great physician. He described diabetes. And in his book, which is called the Sushruta Samhita, which is in two volumes, and still we still use it when we study Ayurveda thousands of years later. The whole book is in the form of poetry because he was a rishi. And he described every disease that is known to man in the form of poetry. He sung it. So if you wanted to become an Ayurvedic physician during Sushruta's time, you went to a school and you learnt music, you learnt singing, you learnt the poetry, and in the end you knew everything. So here's how the symptoms of diabetes are described in English. I'm going to translate that. But when you hear it in Sanskrit, it's a song. But even in English, it sounds great. It says, eating but always hungry, drinking but always thirsty, the poor patient watches his flesh melt away in a stream of sugary urine. That's the description of type 1 diabetes from the writings of Sushruta 4,000 years ago. And that he described as a vata disorder. He said type 1 is really a vata disorder because what you see is a hypermetabolic state. The patient is eating, but he's always hungry. The patient is drinking water, but always thirsty. And all his flesh is melting away in a stream of sugary urine. He says it's a vata disorder and you should be treating it as a vata disorder. And he also described type 2 diabetes, which is a hypometabolic disorder. Even though the symptoms or the complications are the same, the blindness and all these complications, he said that this is a kapha disorder because here, you know, the patient is obese, they're not metabolizing the fat in their body, they're slow, they're phlegmatic. And, of course, he didn't use the word insulin resistance or anything because that's a biochemical concept. Remember, this is a consciousness-based model. He said there's another type of diabetes that is a kapha balancing program is required. So when it comes to diet, and this morning you learned a lot about diet, in type 1 diabetes, you actually give people a vata balancing diet. And a vata balancing diet is sweet, sour and salt, which intuitively at the first time you say, gosh, are you going to give type 1 diabetes sugar? But remember, sweet doesn't mean just sugar, it means all complex carbohydrates. And now there is a lot of good data that supports that, that in fact in type 1 diabetes you give high-load carbohydrate diets. And that makes it much easier to manage these people because you can monitor the insulin and so on. In type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, you give a kapha balancing diet, which is the diet which has astringent, bitter, pungent tastes and helps you mobilize kapha, helps you treat obesity. So at this time, it is very clear that the type of diet that you give to diabetics, and type 3 you would treat as type 2 anyway because it's a majority onset type of diabetes in the young, through a kapha balancing diet. So it's now very clear that there are two different kinds of diet programs for diabetes. Not every diabetic is given exactly the same diet. Diet is according to body type. Now, in addition, what you can give is nutritional supplements, particularly to type 2 diabetics, because if you give them kapha balancing nutritional supplements, which are these herbal combinations that have astringent, bitter, and pungent taste, then you will speed up their metabolism. If you give them kapha balancing herbal tea, you'll speed up their metabolism. And the same thing is true. If you give vata balancing herbal tea or vata balancing herbal powders in type 1 diabetes, you will begin to slow down their metabolism. What about exercise? Again, exercise is a very, very important factor in the treatment of diabetes. But in vata body types, which is type 1 diabetes, you have to be very careful because if you overdo your exercise, and these people are extremely sensitive to insulin, remember they are insulin deficient, you can immediately cause what is called a hypoglycemic episode or It's a good thing, by the way, to do for any patient with any chronic illness. You want to get ama out. So it's a good thing to do. And remember, when you start this, you tell them maybe do it for 2 days a week or 3 days a week. And if you're a vata body type and you have a chronic illness, then be very careful, because I've had patients who have vata body type, and you know, I've told them you can start this hot water routine, and they find suddenly, you know, how vatas are, they get more energetic, even more than they have, and they find that their symptoms are good, so they get over enthusiastic about it, and soon they start to lose weight so rapidly that they become completely very thin and asthenic and dangerously so. So you have to be careful when you prescribe this, especially to a vata body type. Okay, what about herbs in diabetes? Most of the herbs that are used in diabetes are most effective in type 2 diabetes. We have never come across a case where in type 1 diabetes you could eliminate insulin altogether. But in fact, you can do wonderful things. You can reduce the dosage of insulin. You can reduce the frequency of insulin. You can really help these patients through herbs and diet and the Ayurvedic routine that I have mentioned. But in all cases, you'll still need a little bit of insulin. You know, I have had patients who required 2 units of insulin, once in the morning, maybe 2 units in the evening, or maybe not even twice a day, 5 units once in the morning. So that's nutritional supplements, eating awareness. And another thing that helps is what we call, and maybe David has spoken to you about this, the hot water regime or hot water treatment. Has he spoken to you about this? Okay, so you ask the patient to every morning to fill up a thermos with boiling hot water or ginger water or water with a little lemon. You fill it up, but really make it hot and boiling. And then you instruct the patient that every half an hour, they take a few sips of it. It's not even the amount, it's the frequency. And you also tell them to look at their tongue in a mirror. And what you ask them to monitor, and this is a very simple Ayurvedic way of monitoring toxins in the body, is that if they have a lot of toxins in the body, ama, you know what ama is, right? AMA. Okay. If they have a lot of toxins in the body, if they have a lot of ama in the body, then their tongue will be coated and muddy and their breath will be stale and not pleasant. If there is no ama in the body, then your tongue is pink and moist, and your breath feels fresh. So it's that simple to monitor ama. So you prescribe this hot water, either ginger water or lemon water, or plain hot water, boiling hot,